Hello and welcome to the Back Page, a video games podcast. I'm Samuel Roberts and I'm joined as ever by Matthew Castle.
Hello.
Matthew, just before we recorded this, I was at minute 104 of Killers of the Flower Moon and still not halfway through the film.
What had happened? What was the last major event at 104 minutes? Because it's been a while since I saw it.
Honestly, the last hour has mostly been Native American people being offed quietly by all-time bastard Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And like, it's like some of the most evil shit I've ever seen in a film. It's just like extraordinary, really. And Jesse Plemons still hasn't turned up, so I'm assuming he will at some point.
Okay, so you're pre-Plemons. That's good to know.
Yeah. Does it become a slightly different film when Plemons shows up? Because I'm sort of like, wow, how many more people around this poor woman are they going to kill before Plemons turns up in his cowboy hat? You know what I mean?
That feels like a video game mechanic. You've got a bar that fills up, and if it hits the top, Plemons arrives.
Well, like Mr. X, but he solves mysteries.
I'd say like Mr. X, or maybe like the kind of misery meter in Fahrenheit. It's like too many sad things have happened, so Jesse Plemons has to turn up to solve it.
That's good. I think we've used Mr. X as an analogy too often on this podcast.
Oh,
I don't know
no,
if you
never.
Feel that way.
Everything is funnier when it's imagined as Mr. X.
I feel like anytime someone asks us, come up with a game mechanic, you know, in a remake of a game, we always just like take Mr. X and stick it in another game. I feel like that has
Then the genius of that, if I may say so myself, is identifying who the Mr. X is in every single narrative scenario that exists in the world.
That is true.
You know, as an exercise, I would do a whole episode on readers to submit a load of pop culture, anything you want, and we will tell you who Mr. X is in it.
Yeah. I guess, like, I was going to say One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but it's really obvious who Mr. X is, isn't it? Yeah. So, Wow, okay. What about The Age of Innocence, the Scorsese film, another Scorsese film?
The Age of Innocence. I mean, I sort of.
Winona Ryder?
Mr. X is Winona Ryder, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
She's just coming to bust up that relationship, and it's inevitable. And she's just always there. I mean, she's a very dainty, small Mr. X, but she is Mr. X. I guess Mr. X in that film is just kind of like societal expectation.
Yeah, the concept. It's a bit hard to sort of visualize.
But it's embodied in Winona Ryder.
Yeah, okay, let's keep. I mean, okay, Daniel Day-Lewis, Phantom Thread. What have you got for that?
Oh, interesting. I mean,
He is kind of Mr. X, and so is she a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's what happens if two Mr. X's have a relationship. It's just a nightmare. It's a total nightmare time. It's not Leslie Manville as the sister. I mean, she's the...
I guess she's only has so much power. She's just sort of a bit stern, isn't she, really?
Yeah,
lots to think about there. Okay, well, that's something you can think about in the, you know, in the sort of background while we're recording this episode. So that'd be good, I think. Nourishing content to come back to for the listeners. So this episode, Matthew, one of the biggest games of the year, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. We talked about it a bit on a What We've Been Playing episode that we did last month, but we wanted to revisit the game with more detailed thoughts. So that's what we're doing this episode. To give the listeners an idea up front of what we'll be talking about spoiler-wise, because no one respects the sanctity of a spoiler-free video game experience more than me, we're going to discuss this game in a mostly top-line way. We will discuss some events that happen in Final Fantasy VII, the main game, and a little bit on how what Rebirth makes of them, without spoiling specifics. So the idea is it's like a top-line look at the game, and it won't ruin it for you or me, because I have not finished it either. So,
Well,
in fact, Matthew, you've not finished it either, right?
No, I haven't. No. I am, you know, for people who are familiar with the original game, I am about to go on the date at the Golden Saucer.
Wow. And how long have you been playing at this point, Matthew?
About 70 hours.
Bloody hell. So this is a very big game then.
This is a big game. I think it can be done in a lot shorter time if you just mainline the main quest. But if you want to spend lots of time with your party, get up those social connections, and hopefully, he said, with everything crossed, go on a date with the lovely Tifa, then that's really where it comes from. It really does feel like maybe 40 hours of what I've done has been side content, which really the only benefit of doing, aside from leveling up to tackle some bosses, is to spend some quality time with Tifa and just please let that time not have been a waste. Or Yuffie, or Yuffie.
He's only 16 years old.
We don't know what I think this is vague. We don't know this for sure.
It sounds like an excuse in court, this does. But that's fine.
Okay. Tifa or Yuffie. And yeah. If it goes horribly wrong, Red 13.
I'd be happy to go on a date with Barrett, honestly. I think that's like, I'm happy when the whole thing sort of played for laughs. I think Barrett's a good hang, you know?
And I've been told by someone who has done the date and did date Barrett that actually it was a really like nice scene and is, you know, without getting into it, is kind of satisfying in other ways. Like, it still addresses some of the stuff you may hope to have addressed in some of the other dates. So they kind of relate to each other in an interesting way, apparently.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, it gives me a lot to think about. In some ways, I think as well, the romance element of Final Fantasy VII is kind of the bit I'm the least invested in. It's not really something that I have a lot of baggage with. So it's interesting that so much of the game seems to hinge on that.
I'd say I'm leaning into some of that stuff for you know, the
comedic effect.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying it's like a genuine obsession of mine.
No, that's fine. Nor did I think it was in the same way that Japanese crime fiction is, for example. But or cheeseburgers.
Like
if
that door opens at the spooky hotel at the Golden Saucer, and instead of Tifa or Yuffie, it's just a pile of newly translated Higashino books. I'd be like, fantastic. This truly is the greatest game of the year. And Cloud then spends 100 hours just reading a book in a Ferris wheel. I would be over the moon. That would be my game of the year for sure.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so let's step back ever so slightly. Yes. So this game then, second of three games in this Final Fantasy VII remake project that Square Enix has been doing. 2020 was the first one, obviously released during the pandemic, then released on PS5 a little bit later with a Yuffie expansion. The key thing to take away from that is that they mostly retold the story of Final Fantasy VII, but it had a completely new dialogue in it, an expanded story, and there was a suggestion that things will not necessarily play out exactly the same way as part of the story. There's a kind of strange metatextual aspect to it where the authors of the game are essentially playing with the idea of what if the key moment that occurs in Final Fantasy VII, i.e. the death of Aerith, the thing that everyone talks about after all these years, what if there's a possibility space where that doesn't necessarily happen? At the same time, they redid the combat, so it was a kind of hybrid of real-time action and the traditional turn-based combat that Final Fantasy VII and all of the earlier Final Fantasy games were renowned for, and it sort of really hit the spot in that respect. This second game has drawn massive acclaim from critics. It is sat at 93 on Metacritic. It's the most acclaimed Final Fantasy in years. I think 16 really sort of warmed people up for good modern Final Fantasy. Mm. Obviously 14 in the background has sort of been doing good work on this too, but this has sort of cemented Final Fantasy again as sort of one of the sort of key concerns in modern games, I guess. A key series. It doesn't feel like it's out of step with the times in the way that maybe people thought it did back when Final Fantasy 13 released. Maybe that's a good place to start, actually, Matthew. What do you think of the way this game has been perceived versus Remake, but also as part of the series in general?
What strikes me about its popularity and its reviews is that there's a lot of people who are being quite open and explicit about it being a real heart pick. You know, for a game that has scored this high, there's actually a fair bit of negativity in the reviews, and there's a lot of criticisms you can very easily throw at this game. You know, a lot of people talking about the extreme bloat of it and the need to turn a 20-hour segment of game into a potentially 100-plus-hour thing. It seems kind of preposterous, but what they do with that time and all that space has clearly like really resonated. It's definitely supercharged by that nostalgia or that connection with the earlier game. Like, it's a super obvious thing to say, but you know, Final Fantasy 16 or a new Final Fantasy just very rarely has that kind of foundation it can build on. But I think particularly with this one over, say, Remake, is that I think they've really drilled into what people like about these characters and given you a lot more of that. I think Remake, for all its meta weirdness, was a bit more of a I don't know. I just want to say it's a straight retelling, because this is a straight retelling too, but the characters there, a lot of the stuff you saw for them was exactly what you expected. Where here, like, you get to spend like quality time with these characters, which I don't think you did in Remake, and I don't think you necessarily did in the original game either. And like, that weird like alchemy of things has just added up into this, yeah, I mean, spectacular success for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of kind of where things have landed. And I think it's also okay to come into this without having the sort of baggage of being a Final Fantasy fan, because I do think there's also, you know, a point where I think dwelling on the past has little relevance to the series in terms of where it's at creatively. Like, in some ways, I think the era of Final Fantasy this is kind of in sort of starts with 13, because it was that transition into HD, and then you've seen this kind of like gradual journey since then of them figuring out in terms of mechanics and, you know, the overall game design, what is a modern Final Fantasy supposed to look like? Is it turn-based combat in a tunnel? It turns out that people don't necessarily love that. They felt like they needed to contemporize it a little bit more. So, you know, you had a first push into real-time action with Final Fantasy 15. And, you know, most people would say that's not a complete success, even though it's successful in some ways. And then things kind of like move along a long way with 16. And then the 7 Remake is kind of like a parallel track to 16 in some ways. It's like partly has the DNA of an action game, but also, or a third person sort of hack and slash game. But then at the same time, it does have that Final Fantasy 13 stagger system and legacy Final Fantasy 7 sort of like character turn-based stuff built in as well as a kind of like layer of the combat. So it's just an interesting journey to track. Like, there really is some true evolution in there, and it's nice to see people get excited about this series again, you know?
If it has a, like, the one I keep coming back to is like youthful energy. It feels like the work of a slightly younger team who, you know, are willing to sort of try sort of sillier things. Obviously, that requires senior gatekeepers who remain, you know, basically the same people they have for 20 years now to like allow that and encourage that. So it's not saying that they're flawed in any way, but I find the director of this, Naoki Hamaguchi, to be quite an interesting character. You know, he's been quite sort of front and centre in a lot of the promotional campaigns for it. And he did one of those, you know, the big Game Informer covers they do. And they did one of those, you know, we ask him 150 questions in 10 minutes type thing. And, you know, he came off as very sort of personal and had a sort of sense of humour, like really kind of understood the concept, but also just talked quite openly about his gaming tastes, and very informed by like modern Western open world games. You know, he says like The Witcher 3 is his favorite game, for example. And I think when you play this game, you can sense some of that osmosis happening between what things a lot of people like and what goes into this game, where sometimes these things could be a bit little kind of closed off and strange and almost like rejecting the norms out of some kind of, you know, tradition or sense, like, well, we don't do it that way, we do it our own way. And actually, you know, this game is quite conservative as open world games go, but with those conservative ideas come the stability that come with a lot of conservative ideas, I guess. If you compare this with 15, if 15 felt like it was never really sort of found its feet and you know, kind of took some sort of wild swings, and I think Rebirth still has a lot of the charm of 15, the character stuff you really love in it, but it also gets those fundamentals right, and that's really what's made this work in a way that they haven't before. I don't even remember what the question was. I don't think that answers it.
No, I think that's fine. I think it's sort of, I think we're just talking back and forth about how Final Fantasy got to this point, basically.
Yes, yeah.
I think that, you talking about the younger developers is interesting. So something I keep thinking about when I'm playing this is, even compared to Remake, and certainly compared to 16, which, you know, obviously the different development teams and they have different leadership and all that stuff, but you have to assume that there's some studying of what other people are doing within the company, right? Because surely, like, you know, these games are, they can't live in a vacuum from each other. They are sort of like different versions, different ways to tackle the same problem, right? Of how do you make a contemporary Final Fantasy game that's not not necessarily open world, but has open world elements to it. This is more open than 16 is, but you know, in some places it's not necessarily. Either way, you just think there must be some crossover there. But the thing I was going to ask was, do you think there's a little bit of Persona influence on the way they've drawn attention to character interaction in this? The way that characters are tied to certain side quests or turn up in cutscenes, or how they just dwell on the idea of you and the other characters in your party spending time together. Do you think that's possibly an influence on this? Because that's not really an element of Remake, but it feels very firmly like a focus of this game.
Yeah, it's weird, the social element in this game, because it's not really a social system a la Persona, you know. It's not an actual simulation, and neither is it like, you know, a Mass Effect build your party. I mean, yes, you can technically, you know, select the two people who fight in your trio, but you know, the other people are there as well. It's like very much its own thing. It really just feels to me like someone looked at the original and went, if we're going to show this game in a photorealistic way or rendered with modern technology where you can really show everything as it's meant to be, we have to answer the question of where does the party go during the open world sections? Are they there or are they not there? And if they are there, it just feels like everything sort of flows from that. You know, just making that simple choice of, no, they don't vanish into Cloud's pocket. They are behind him. So every cutscene he arrives at, the party is there. And so logically, we have to write those scenes as if the party was going to be there. We always know which party's going to be there. So it doesn't have the choices and consequences of like a BioWare game, for example. It feels more kind of pragmatic from a stemming from like a desire to show what a party would realistically look like traveling,
right,
rather than, oh, I feel like they're trying to make a gameplay mechanic of this party. It just feels like a purely like narrative thing that just has like big ramifications.
Yeah, that's the thing. I sort of like, I don't mean the Persona influence in the sense of, you know, there is a mechanic tied to it, because like you other than the Golden Saucer date thing, there's not really there isn't a mechanic tied to them. But it's more just the feeling of like friendship being a key element in an RPG. I just think that's,
yeah,
it feels like in the last few years that has just become more of a big deal, you know?
You know, you're right in that social element, like wherever if it stems from a single game or it's just where tastes now lie, is everywhere. From your Marvel's Midnight Suns to your Fire Emblems trade so much more now on these people being good friends or like potential boyfriends, girlfriends and all that. Maybe there's just some like evil market research somewhere that shows that you know, friendship really resonates with the kids, you know, like it's kinder, less cynical times, maybe,
or maybe just, you know, it's sort of people spend more time indoors and like having virtual friends. I don't know,
maybe we're just more comfortable with virtual friends, or there was a time where I would be mortified at the idea of joking about wanting to go on a date with Tifa, you know, or joking about Miranda in Mass Effect 2. You know, these were once dirty habits that had to be kept behind closed doors. But now anything goes. In the age of, it's not just performative horniness, it's in the age of, what is it? What is that? How do you even describe that thing?
I don't know, like sort of thirst or sort of like...
Yeah, but there's like no embarrassment about having any kind of feelings about a digital puppet.
Yeah, and I've said this before, I think a little bit of shame goes a long way, and I think it's sort of like, I think it will hold you in good stead, a little bit of shame. But I think that is in any case, that has become like a more noticeable part of RPGs, whether it's down to Persona or something else. It's you know, even games like the Thaumaturge, that game seems to have some kind of like detailed sort of like companion element to it as well. And it's just
whenever I watch Catherine playing on a PC, it just seemed to be, you know, a rather ill looking man in very kind of drab bars talking to sad looking drunkards. So
I totally want to play that.
It didn't scream Thirst Trap.
No, I don't think that's going for that. I think that's going for something a little bit earthier. I don't know, but it's that game looks rad. I will definitely come back to it.
What's earthy thirst?
So I suppose, Matthew, you have played this a lot more than me. I've played 14 hours of this. You've played 70 hours of this. I did want to play more to the listener. But if you want to know a bit about how these podcasts get made, so for Patreon people who have downloaded our Hitman Blood Money episode, that episode is basically like taken 10 hours away from me playing Final Fantasy VII because I played Hitman Blood Money for a week instead. So
yeah,
that's a little bit about how these things get made there. Hope you enjoy that. But you, Matthew, are many more hours into it than me. You've had it a little bit longer than me. Mm-hmm. So what are your overall feelings on FF7 Rebirth?
I'm having a great time with it, and I think it really does come down to how they have rendered the party, and it may lack kind of systemic depth as a party goes outside of combat preferences, but I think they've taken a load of characters who are like iconic, but I found it hard to form that bond with when I was playing, you know, Final Fantasy VII, you know, only last year. I didn't come away with it going like, yeah, Barrett's an all-timer, or Tifa, what a wonderful character. You know, I thought several of them were kind of drips that I couldn't believe people had kind of carried a flame for them for this many years. But obviously I haven't finished it, so I don't know how things are going to play out right at the end. But I just can't see myself leaving this game without huge affection for them. And making that a pillar of the game just pays off in so many ways. It gives that side content a little bit of colour because there's another voice in the mix. You're not just doing all this crap, but you're doing this crap and, you know, Barrett, Tifa, Yuffie, whoever is kind of weighing in on it with their distinct voice, and that just helps elevate it a little bit. Brings out like a kind of goofiness where, you know, Cloud is less of the focus, and he's so sort of stoic and grim in the original that I think him only being a seventh or an eighth or whatever it is of the party just lets this game be so much more vibrant. Like, some really silly extra stuff happens. You know, they take iconic moments. I think they're very good at making sure they tick off like all the key bits you want to see, but they're not embarrassed about then going, well, and we never really knew what Red 13 was up to on this boat ride, so here's what happens with him. Here's a little kind of sight gag with him that we're going to do, or we're going to have a little kind of musical number with some characters or whatever. And whether it was very cleverly engineered to make sure you were never more than like an hour away from the party doing something charming, they really have carried me through it. And that isn't what I felt about the first one. I think the first one, I was carried through it by wanting to see the next set piece, you know, wanting to see how they'd taken this thing, which, you know, you really clearly remember, and have grown it up and blown it out. You know, how are they going to do Don Corneo's mansion, Honeybee Inn? How are they going to do Shinra Tower? And that still goes here, and they still absolutely nail those things. But underneath it all is just a great party, a great group of people to go on a big trip with.
Yes, it's a funny thing as well, because I don't necessarily think that's why the original Final Fantasy VII is great. You know,
no, not at all.
Like, there's great party members, absolutely, but, you know, not all of them are massively developed. In some ways, I think it's about the mystery of Sephiroth, and, you know, the sort of like the idea of what will happen to the planet, and the sort of the idea of Shinra chasing you. I think it's very plot-driven as opposed to character-driven, the original game.
I mean, having not done all the big, you know, not played Disc 2 and 3, people keep telling me, like, oh, man, that's where the real plot stuff happens. So I can only imagine what that is. But
Yes and no, I would say.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of like, yeah, I would say some of the larger set pieces are Disc 2 and 3. But the a lot of people, I think it's quite front loaded, Disc 1. I think it's sort of like a lot of the key stuff does happen in Disc 1. So okay. It's just that the scale of it just grows and grows in Disc 2 and 3. It just becomes,
right.
I don't want to spoil it for you. If you don't know about it, then you can go.
No,
and
I don't. That is the kind of crazy thing, is like this game's discourse is so dominated by a couple of things, basically Midgar and what happens at the end of Disc 1. I don't really know what goes beyond Disc 1.
Yeah.
I know there's some, like, I know what Sephiroth's plan is, and so I've got a general idea of, like, well, you know, I imagine X, Y, and Z could happen. You know, and I've heard you and other people talk about the weapons being a thing, but I don't really know what they are. Well, actually, I do now, because, you know, they actually are surfaced a little earlier, it seems, in Rebirth, to give you a taste of it.
Well, they got to get some of those assets made, so they don't have to make all these weapons for the third game.
Yeah, there are definitely locations in this where they're absolutely like mined within an inch of their life, and you think, oh, this is everything this place is ever going to be. And then there are places where you think, are we going to come back here, you know, later in the story? Like, is this place's story truly told? But I genuinely don't know, so.
Yeah, okay, interesting. So, yeah, I think it is it's quite intriguing that they've managed to find a strength in this second game in a remake trilogy that has a different, an identifiable different sort of like selling point to the original game. That's like a, that's a much bigger achievement, I think, than anything that Remake did, where I think Remake was kind of the miracle of it was it existed, you know, they did it, and that it looked nice, and it had many of the key moments you liked, and
good combat. It was,
exactly. So there was plenty it got right, and then this, I guess that's one of the many ways in which it's built on the original. So I suppose I do want to ask about length a little bit, Matthew, because, well, actually, let me ask a little bit about side quests first, because I think that ties to length a little bit as well. So we talked a bit about on that what we've been playing episode about how the side quests in this game are good. I have talked about how I've done my sort of like Clive get me some onions quests, sort of like banter on the end of year episodes last year. And like, yeah, we definitely, you especially dinged 16 for its side quests, and yet you have really engaged with it here. So I suppose like, to tie this into one question then, so why are those side quests more creatively successful than they were in 16? I guess character we know is part of it, but I don't know if there's anything else about the design of the quest. But also, how do you think this game justifies being as long as it is?
I mean, its justification, I think, really is as simple as we really like these characters, we think you really like these characters, so it's okay that you spend all this time with them. And did they get that balance wrong? It's going to change for different people. I've seen on our Discord, for example, people who are like, after one area, they're like, oh, Jesus, like, fuck Chadley and fuck the Far Cry map and fuck the Ubisoftification of this franchise. Well, if you feel that way after, like, one portion of it, there are many more portions like this to come. And I never really felt that way. And I'm not as burnt out on that stuff as some people. Like, my brain is capable of switching down a couple of notches and clearing some map filler and just enjoying the music and all that kind of stuff. You know, that works for me. I'm the guy who liked Assassin's Creed Valhalla. I'm not like I have room in my heart for these kind of games, and I appreciate the subtleties of them. I don't like it that they get just bundled in together as like, oh, they are all one and the same. You're like, there are very distinct, interesting things. But anyway, that's a bigger conversation for another time. What I do like about the side quests is I actually think, you know, and here I'm probably talking more about like specifically scripted, structured side quests rather than, say, go to five caves and take a picture of five magic rocks, which is a task which is in every single one of the region. That is more kind of map filler. But in terms of like the bespoke missions that you can go on outside of the story, I think some of them are fun opportunities to like grow out the kind of lore of that world and give you a better sense of place, which I'm quite into because I think they've clearly had a sort of thought about what lies between all these things which are famous. You know, how does this place function? You know, what is its culture and society? And I don't mind learning about that. I think that's interesting. I think they've taken side characters or very tiny, you know, NPCs who maybe had a line of dialogue in the original game and sort of taken that and sort of blown it out into a side quest. So you just get to know a lot more people and you get to have a sense of like ownership. You sort of understand the stakes of this world a bit better because you understand its people a bit better, and that I really like. I also think just as mechanical things, I think there's a bit more going on in this game. Like, you know, we'll talk later about the mini games, but this is a game which is not afraid to just invent something for the sake of, you know, a 5-minute distraction. They're like, well, this quest needs this mechanic, so I guess we'll just invent this whole mini game so this can happen. The quality of them do vary, but if you are into the mad excess of like AAA games, there is something quite delirious about, you know, like, I can't believe they made the X into a game. Everyone suddenly turned into a frog and there's like a weird frog battling game that we're doing for like 20 seconds, and it's completely throwaway and I guess reflected in the original game. The original game was also laced with weird mini games that just came and went in a flash, and it's kind of adapting that and dealing with that. But you know, I've seen plenty of people say I would settle for like 10% of the mini games, but they were all like 100% better. I get that, but in terms of, you know, your side quests having more just verbs for you to do to build those quests out of, that was the problem with 16. It's like all Clive could do was have a fight. Everywhere he went, Clive would go and have a fight, and there was nothing more to him than a man who had a fight, where Cloud can go and be sort of 1,000 different things based on these mini games. And I don't know. I think that's pretty rad.
I think that I've stumbled across this in my head now of why you love this game. What they've done, Matthew, is they've made Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles the Crystal Bearers again. And they made like a big open world with loads of mini games in it. And surprise, surprise.
Oh my God. That is what they did.
Yeah. That just dawned on me as you were saying. It's like, why is it what is the Final Fantasy game that really clicked with Matthew the most? It was that fucking one that's got like 80 different mini games in it, like spread around a world. And yeah, I think that's it, my friend.
Oh,
I think
my God. I mean, yeah, that is true. I do like that. You know, I like the, you know, it goes back to, you know, Zelda having like a weird little mini game in every shop or whatever. You know, that stuff has always kind of tickled me. There are versions which are more substantial, like, you know, the way that they blend in the in-world card game Queen's Blood. It is just Gwent. And there you can see this director loves The Witcher 3 and he's gone, oh, I liked how in that game, every town you went to, you could just play this mini game and like build out your deck. But also there were side quests where someone was like, this can only be decided in Queen's Blood. Or main story events where like, now you've got to play Queen's Blood for something quite high stakes. And I fucking love that in The Witcher and I love that here. I mean, games should always do that. That will always be good to me.
Mm. That's cool. Yeah, so I do agree in the sense that it puts more meat on the bones than I think we even said that 16 just didn't have any mini games and therefore that drew attention to the fact that what you were only doing was going to a place and you know, battering someone with a series of very nicely animated sort of cool physical / magical attacks. So I think that is one way in which it's differentiated quite significantly. I agree with that. Okay, so what do you think it improves from Remake, Matthew?
I do think the writing is a big step up. I just think these characters are better. Maybe they're in a space where they can be a bit more fun. Everything in Midgar in Remake is so, you know, it's a terrorist group going on sort of suicide missions for the meat of the game, and then all of their friends get crushed to death so they have a bit of revenge. You know, no one in that is having fun. Like, if anything, in that game, the couple of bones it throws you always seem out of place. In Remake, when Barrett's like, you're like, Barrett, thousands of people just died. Like, this is not the time to be fucking cute, man. Like, if anyone should understand that, it's you. But here, you know, Barrett singing, loads of people singing the Final Fantasy Mission Complete tune. Kate Sith does a little meow version of it, which I quite like.
Controversially, I don't like this in the game.
Okay.
I think it's just too on the nose as a kind of like reference to the... That's like a player-facing thing. I don't think it really makes sense. And it's
okay, maybe not that specific thing is like, oh, I fucking like this particular thing. But
I fully own that I'm a grump with that opinion.
No, but it's
like,
more
it's, you know,
it's more that what it represents in terms of how silly this game is. When you get to the Gold Saucer, something happens that is just... It's so goofy, but like so intentionally funny and executed brilliantly. Like, this is actually... I saw Ash Day comment on this actually on Twitter, saying he asked, like, does anyone else think Final Fantasy Rebirth is like one of the most intentionally funny games in terms of like, this is just a good comedy game that is going for comedy and actually lands quite a lot of its jokes.
Right.
I think that's what he was going for. If he was being sarcastic and he actually thinks it's terrible, then I missed it. But I do think, given how lame a lot of the attempts of humour in the Remake were, see the rest of Avalanche. This game, I think, is very funny. I've lost track of what we were talking about.
I actually just asked how does this improve from Remake?
Oh yeah,
but yeah.
So it's funnier.
that's fair.
That's what I'm saying. It's funnier. I think the fact that it has these open regions, you just get a true sense of what these places are like, rather than looking at amazing background art from a path. You get to sort of take them in, and the tourism element of it is that much richer as a result. I mean, you're not going to be spending like Zelda Breath of the Wild hours in this open world seeing all its possibilities. Like, it can be exhausted quite quickly, but just being in it and seeing again the excess of them is often quite kind of overwhelming of holy shit, like they've actually, you know, really gone for this. And I, you know, something that's just happened, and you know, I'm definitely not going to spoil this, but there's a thing in chapter 12 which you know, people who are ahead of the game in me had said, like, wait till you get to chapter 12. Something pretty cool happens in chapter 12. And I got there, and you sort of realize the true nature of what they've built, and it's in quite an interesting way. And, you know, that's all I'll sort of say on that. When you played Remake, it was quite hard to imagine Rebirth because of the size of the world. You're like, well, they're not going to do all that world. You know, it's not going to be like a Fallout game, is it? And then you play it, and it's like, not really. But then the more you play it, the more you're like, is it actually? Like, this is actually a lot more connected than I thought it was going to be. They've tried to capture the kind of the rhythm of how you explored in Final Fantasy VII original and how that map evolved over time with vehicles, or how certain things opened it up and kind of recontextualized it. And I feel like they've actually had a proper go at capturing some of those moments here. Again, very hard to talk about without like stepping on its toes, but I thought there was a loading screen between these locations, and maybe there's something more there, and they have attempted to address that.
It's quietly very next gen as games go.
Right.
It's sort of like,
yeah,
you know, it's sort of, I must admit, early on there is a bit where you shimmy through a wall where I was like, oh no, are they going to port this back to PS4 in a year or something? But then you realize that's kind of just a bit of an outlier, and then you sort of like, when you start doing side quests around Calm, the first town you're in, you start to realize that, oh, that it's not actually loading anything. I might be in like a tunnel for a minute, but that's kind of about as much as you get. And then when you're in the open world, you see like the aircraft over Calm, like it's there in the world with you, and that scale of things is actually really impressive. It's sort of, I don't think it ever feels like, you say, like sort of Fallout or like, you know, any kind of like big open sort of, like, you look at wide open space. It sort of has, it ebbs and flows a bit. There are some areas that feel more like tunnels, like slightly, you know, sort of wide linear thing, and then there are some areas that do feel like, oh, you can spend a few hours here, sort of like pottering around.
Like, weirdly, probably the thing that's closest to is how they did the open world in like Metro Exodus,
right?
Which was another place where it's like, this is a very authored space, but it is a wide space. But, you know, you will see it kind of at the pace we want you to see it, and we have subtle control over it. I know one trick that they do repeatedly is each area has a chocobo you have to catch, which has a unique traversal mechanic to it. And they can use that chocobo and when it turns up and what its power is to really kind of like, they can give you the whole area at once, or they can force you to basically walk through a corridor and return later and see that corridor then blows all the way up into something else. And the opening grasslands outside Calm, you know, the chocobo, it can run, it can go through swamps, and there's like one swamp that you need to go through. When you get to Cosmo Canyon, where there's sort of a mechanic which sort of hinges on flight and gliding, and then suddenly it becomes this huge sort of vertiginous, you know, there's levels at the top of the canyon, there's level at the bottom of the canyon, there's all this kind of interesting stuff in between, and they definitely hold back some of the real wow moments. So, you know, if you're kind of into it at that earlier stage, I think the really good stuff doesn't really happen until like the second half.
Okay, interesting. I think that the thing as well that to bear in mind with this is that it, you know, Final Fantasy VII wasn't an open world game. It just had some world map areas you could go around.
Yeah.
And then at the very end of the game, which I would hazard a guess at maybe what you're alluding to in Chapter 12, I kind of feel like I kind of know where you're going with that. But like they, you know, they give you the airship and you can go around the entire world, and you can, it then starts to have the illusion of an open world, but really you're just going back to all the places you went to before.
Right.
But the spaces were designed to be explored in a linear fashion. It just happens to be like maybe one or two locations per continent that is like some optional content for you to see.
Right.
So it's sort of like, it probably was quite a hard one to figure out, because it's sort of like, it is, you know, way more open than Midgar, but it's not, you know, these are the days before open world games, really. It was still kind of meant to be this authored quest. So, yeah.
But I kind of love that about it. I love that they have thought, you know, what is our equivalent of that step up from Midgar? You know, what is that middle ground? It isn't Fallout. It's still kind of controlled. Like, you still have to hit these story beats in a particular order, so you can't go completely off the leash. And also, you know, that, you know, the thing you say about, like, the airship, that isn't the thing, incidentally, in Chapter 12.
Okay.
you know, I often remember people talking about these games, you know, in the playground where they were like, when you finally get X and the whole world opens up. When you look at it now, it's so rudimentary. You know, you're basically moving like an icon of a vehicle across this very basic map. I think they have wanted to go back and go, well, what, you know, what does that look like in a photorealistic way? Like, can we do a proper car in this game? And what would that feel like? Can we, you know, can we take what they did in Final Fantasy 15, but make it way more like fun and responsive and like open to exploration? And everything you like in this game, you can trace it back to an idea in the original, which is quite a fun exercise of like, oh, I kind of see they're trying to tap into this particular thing. It's not just that you get a car, it's that this is what a car kind of means in this world. And that just seems like very, very playful to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. And yeah, I think that dials in on the philosophy behind how they've designed the world. That makes sense. So I suppose, like, to talk about some of the more meat and potatoes stuff of this, Matthew, like, the combat is kind of the same as Rebirth. I mean, as Remake. I should have just written fucking Remake there, shouldn't I? Let's just change that so I don't keep saying the wrong fucking word. Yeah.
Just for the listeners, there's a document and it has the word Rebirth in it, and it's really throwing this whole pot.
Yeah, it's completely.
It's one Monday use of the word Rebirth.
Monday, yeah, Monday evening brain, and yeah, it's the one my my brain is drawn to. So talking a bit more about the combat, for example, as a kind of more meat and potatoes element of this game, it does feel like maybe it's a touch faster than it was in 7 Remake. That might just be my memory being a bit skewed, but there are also other ways in which they've added to it. So you have, you know, more characters, obviously. So where I am, I've got Red 13, but you mentioned Kat Sheath. Is that how you meant to say it? I don't know.
No, they say Kate Sith.
Kate Sith, yeah. But I think there was one of the very minor C-level discourses on social media about that. And then I assume they add, well, Yuffie obviously come into it at some point, and they already designed her for the DLC. Mm. So you have more characters to choose from. They've added a system called Folios as well, which is essentially like, I think that this particular portion of Final Fantasy designers are obsessed with the sphere grid from Final Fantasy X.
Right.
Because it's popped up in different forms. In like 13, like, it's popped up in like most of the Final Fantasy games since then. It's kind of like basically a rudimentary, every level you get a few more SP to spend and you unlock new abilities and new sort of like bonuses to your for your characters. Each member of the party has their own sort of folio to go through, essentially, and unlock this new stuff. So that's another way in which they've built on it. And
do you think that's a Katarzy thing? Because he's involved with 10. And this, definitely this one.
It's possibly, yeah. It's sort of like, it's just weirdly stuck. Like, this, you always see systems like this from this particular strand of the FF, sort of like FF developers. I've never quite known why, but I like seeing it. It's always welcome to me because I like it. It's sort of, here I think it's, at least where I am, Matthew, it's a bit rudimentary. Like, you don't necessarily have loads of control over, you're not crafting a character like you do with the sphere necessarily.
Yeah.
But, you know, the principle of it is that there is another progression element on top of the existing ones. And it's quite an interesting wrinkle because even though the materia system in this returns from Remake, it's actually done, in some ways, the new abilities you unlock kind of like supplement the material you've got, or even soft replace them in some way. So you'll get like a fire-based melee attack spell, and you can use that on enemies who have fire weaknesses rather than spending magic, you know, MP to actually like use a fire spell. And that's an interesting choice because that's where it starts to diverge from what FF7 is. It's like materia is still at the heart of it, but it's layering all this other stuff on top of it. So what do you make of that, the combat side of things, Matthew?
I do think it slightly diminishes materia in this game. I played Remake for the first time just before playing Rebirth, and that game felt like it all hinged on materia and magic points to cast spells was always like the most crucial resource that I was managing. You know, when I had magic points, I was fine. If I didn't have magic points, I was totally fucked. The fact that it gives you, like you say, a layer of elemental magic, which is attached to the ATB meter rather than magic points. So if you do one of these non-materia magic spells, it doesn't cost you any MP. And as a result, you know, a lot of those materia, they kind of they don't only exist, but they mainly exist to be the elemental key to an enemy's weakness, to kind of pressure them. So, you know, if you're really new to all this, there's a staggering system where you build up a stagger bar, but the key to really kind of getting into that is to find what pressures an enemy, because when they're pressured, all your attacks build up the stagger much faster, and often it's just like, use the element they don't like, and then they're instantly pressured, you wail on them for a few seconds, they're staggered, you kill them. So I think the fact that you have all this elemental magic to hand, free of MP, that really speeds combat up, as well as slightly taking the spotlight off materia, definitely in like the first half of the game anyway. The latter half of the game, you begin to get the more playful materia or like stat buff stuff, and it becomes more about using that stuff to supplement your characters while they then use their non-materia magics elsewhere. To sum up, I did find that folio magic lessened both the appeal and necessity of materia for the first half of the game. Like, you can really charge through a lot of the open world fodder. And this is a game where like nothing is dangerous until the bosses, and then the bosses are often quite juicy spikes and a lot more satisfying. Yes, I have to use this materia muscle memory. I have to use all these synergy attacks, which is like another new thing they add to the game. These battles are actually lasting long enough for me to have to make lots of smart decisions, where in the open world, maybe because they know that you're going to be spending so much time there, it feels like very snackable fights.
Yeah, okay. Now, yeah, I think I sort of, even from what I've played so far, I definitely pick up on that. Like the boss fights, of which there are many, you know, pretty much every boss fight that's in the main game pops up here, and that's, you know, they pace out the game nicely, and the chapter by chapter storytelling. Is there a boss at the end of every chapter, Matthew? Is that how they've kind of structured it?
I mean, there's bosses at the end of every chapter. There tends to be a boss halfway through. Often, I mean, the thing this game really likes doing is like the three boss rush at the end of a chapter.
Right,
so you get there and you're like, fuck me, that was difficult. And then it's like another bloke just turns up. I mean, one of the funny side effects of them, you know, they've obviously padded out all the characters in your party, but I think they also want to keep other characters in play who don't have much to do in Disc 1, but are probably essential to what happens at the end of the story. So right. Like Shinra, basically. You know, Shinra, do not a lot in Disc 1 when I played it. You know, you bump into the Turks a couple of times and you see Rufus Shinra at the parade, but that's basically it. Where here, I think most of the Shinra like board of directors have like at least one, if not several, boss fights throughout this game, and they just turn up. You know, you'll have done the fight you remember, and then like, oh, now here's Palmer's turned up, and he's like in some fucking robot, and then you fight him, and then someone's like, oh, they've decked Palmer, better send something else really nasty to punish them. And so you end up doing these like boss runs, which, as a lover of big cinematic boss fights, heaven, I love that shit. But it's not a good game if you want to go to bed, because you're like, oh, fuck me, I just, you can finish, please finish for the session. This is too many bosses in a row.
That's funny. Yeah, I think it's also, it saves, so it's got, like you say, there's these synergy attacks as well, which basically like pair up characters to do like a sort of like a cinematic powerful move. They're really cool, but sometimes there's like context sensitive versions of them in boss fights, Matthew. You'll just get like, you'll see all the HUD elements still there, but then the camera will start panning away and like you're watching basically cutscenes in the middle of combat. And the boss fights, I think, are good at like having those moments, you know, where it's just like it doesn't feel like it takes you out of the action to watch a cutscene. It feels like you're still in the combat, because there's no transition, it just starts. It's very impressive visually.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that as well. Like, that's like presentationally a step up, I think, from what Remake was able to do. So
yeah, it feels very Yakuza-y, actually.
Mm.
You know, your reward for getting through one of the boss's many health bars is that there'll be a little quick time event or a little bit of cinematic sparring in the middle, and it's just fun to watch, and it just looks cool, shows off the character models, shows off all the amazing special effects.
So yeah, I think it's sort of like slightly improved. And I also think that one thing I do like about the fact that the open world combat is not very complicated is that you don't have to like get into the minutia of controlling the different characters if you don't want to. You can just clear them as if it's a real-time action game, in a way that I don't think you ever really played much of Remake like that. But I think it makes sense in a game the size of Rebirth. I think that that actually tracks is a good decision. So I quite like that. It's like I'll only break out my proper strategies for the big boys, you know what I mean? That's that kind of works.
Yeah, it does occasionally throw one or two enemy types, which are like a little nastier, won't break easily or won't be pressured as easily. In the second area, Junon, there's these birds which they're only pressured when you dodge a particular attack they do, and because of that, those are quite like drawn out slugs, you know, because you're waiting for this attack, and then when it happens, they can be quite hard to dodge. And you know, even having leveled up and done plenty of grinding, when I'd return to that area, I'd still feel the sting of them a little bit. Like, it is interesting how that pressure criteria system, the fact that everything has a sort of secret combination that unlocks it and makes it really vulnerable, they can make those as soft or hard as they want. And just by tweaking a couple of them, those, even a regular fight can kind of kick your ass, which I quite like. Remake felt like it was just that all the time. Everything was a pain in the ass in Remake. Well, I say pain in the ass. It was fun the first five times, but...
Yeah, but you got those, like, chocobo stops, and you're like, right, I'm never going through that tunnel with that bastard again.
So, yeah, right.
yeah. So you definitely did your best to kind of avoid it. So I think that's a good assessment of the combat, Matthew. I think it does push it forward in some ways, but also I agree that the progression system actually does, like, muddy the water slightly, and I was there thinking, oh, I don't know if that is an improvement. I can see why they felt like they couldn't keep things exactly the same as they did in Remake, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know, that's there is a reason that Materia worked as sort of neatly as it did. The other thing I would say is that the Materia just never quite functions the same in these games as it does in the original. It's just such a pure, like, numbersy sort of stats-based system in the original, in that, like, the way you tie things together. It's sort of things like the fact that you could get like a 4x sort of like Materia in FF7 and then attach it to a summon like Knights of the Round, who I assume will be in the third one in some way. But like, and then basically you could just do it. So you activate this summon attack and then you do it 4x and then you just watch the animation 4x, which is ridiculous. But I think it speaks to the fact that the system was built to be broken, you know, or manipulated at the very least. And here, it very much feels like you're kept on a leash by Materia, I think. I think it only, like, gets some of the majesty of the original intent of it, which is just to put all this freedom in your hands to mix and match things. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It is a system which comes to life once they've given you certain parts, you know, once they've given you more interesting spells outside of simple elemental Materia, and once they've given you the blue Materia, which you pair with other Materia to amplify it in lots of different ways, then you can begin to have fun with it. And definitely by the end of the game, you've begun to approach some of the fun of that original system. It's kind of like, it's like a programming puzzle, isn't it? It's like, if this, then this, and you can, you know, you can pair certain things up, and you can make it so, you know, you're firing off fire when certain things happen, and that fire is also healing you and returning MP to you, and you can create these little self-sustaining loops. And that side of the game doesn't emerge until, and it doesn't emerge ever in the same way that it did in the original, and it definitely doesn't emerge in its reduced form here until about where I am now, a 70 hour mark. It's kind of a shame, and that is one of the flaws of this being a three-part project, is that, you know, it's the middle part of the game, so you come in with these expectations of what you've done in Midgar, but they also need to have, like, a learning curve. What do they give you from the outset? Do they give you everything that you could have had at the end of Midgar? No, they don't. They give you, like, more than you had at the start of Remake, but it's still, they have to fudge it a little bit. Having to reset and recapture the summons, things like that is a little bit... It can't be as neat as the original, just because the original is one coherent piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's, I agree with that. It's sort of like, where do you start players from? And they kind of went with, well, you're level 15 and you've got some summons, basically. So
because I'm interested, like, you know, the big test of this is going to be the third game. And if after 100 hours of gathering and mining the map for, like, every last thing here, all that goes again, I don't know if that will be felt a bit more kind of aggressively there than it maybe is here.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing for them to tackle, absolutely. By the way, it wasn't 4x Materia, it's Quadra Magic. That was the Quadra Materia I was thinking of. And yeah, you could summon the same summon 4x in a row for the, say, for like one MP cost, basically. It was pretty fucking amazing.
I remember Rob often talking about a Materia which triggers on your death and then partnering it with a summon like Phoenix that brought you back to life. So it was like a guarantee kind of like safety net and things like that. You're like, oh yeah, it's just when you can talk about a system like that and it just fills your head with ideas of like playful combinations, that's when you know you've really got the good shit.
I think that's where it sort of asks interesting questions here about like what, I mean, this is just something that people are always wrestling with. What is an RPG now, right? Because I think we kind of accept that the definition of RPG has changed. But when old school players are upset about the way in which the genre has changed, I think what they're referring to is systems like Materia, or like controlling all of the different characters in Dragon Age, for example, in the way that you do in Origins versus the way that you do in Inquisition. I think they're talking about that, like the way that things get simplified in order to support the kind of like more action-based approach that they've decided to take with how they've designed the game. So I think I kind of see, in this respect, it's like, I wouldn't say that FF7 Rebirth is not an RPG, but I would say that it probably is fairer to say that FF7 is a purer form of old school RPG. That's the thing. I think that this is sort of like at least a hybrid open world action game RPG. Like it's at least that. I don't know if I necessarily call it a pure RPG, but then again, I don't know where that definition has landed these days. But the Materia system is the one thing that really made me think of that. It's like, oh, well, what is this definitely an RPG then, or is this like?
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like it's.
But then coming to this after 16, which has none of this, 16 is. I mean, it really is. It's as much an RPG as, like, Devil May Cry is an RPG, really, in terms of upgrades and how you can develop the character. This feels thirst quenching. You know, you're like, oh my god, this is so rich compared to that. But if you come to it from the original game, you're like, oh, well, it is still a big step down, but. I'm fine with where they've landed it. You know, I think the idea of party and characters clearly being a priority for them, I can understand that they've decided to surface that in these synergy attacks, which, you know, are all about you partnering up with people. Thematically, that system makes more sense for the, you know, what they've done with the wider game than maybe going, you know, every 5 minutes Cloud's going to disappear into a menu and come up with like some mad Materia bullshit for like half an hour. That isn't what the tone of the rest of the game is.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a step down either. It's like a step sideways, you know. Yeah. It's a different way to tackle the same thing. It's sort of like, it's not like FF7 the original has gone anywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just something I thought about. Ooh. Okay, so which of the mini games are a highlight for you, Matthew?
I think Queen's Blood is like legit brilliant. I don't know if you've played much of this.
Yeah, and I can't decide how much of it is just like so far from what I've played. I understand it develops quite a lot. Just like you're basically trying to get to the middle center square and then like basically take it so they just can't move, and that's the entire game really, and there's not much else to it, but you know.
Yeah, that's definitely true early on, and that is still like a valid tactic. Having like a fast spreading deck is one way to win Queen's Blood all through. So if you aren't playing the game, you have a checkered board, like a chess board, but it's sort of more of a horizontal strip. And you have like three lanes that you're placing cards in, but there are limited squares. When you place cards, you kind of, you basically unlock the space next to them or spaces around them to plant more cards. And you're trying to put the highest scoring number of cards in each lane that you can. But obviously, if you can control the majority of the lane, then your rival can't put down as many cards. So they're very unlikely to outscore you, which is why that's a good tactic. But as it goes on, you begin to get cards that destroy other cards already on the board. So the board is constantly shifting. It's not locked in place, which it kind of is for the first 20, 30 hours of the game. You begin to get incredibly high scoring cards. It then isn't about just controlling. It's about, I've got to have the right numbers. You know, this isn't going to go my way. Like, five of my cards could score less than one of their cards. And how am I going to kind of deal with that? And there are many possible routes to victory, which I really like. And there are lots of deck variations. And when you get a new card, your brain does fizz with the possibilities of, this could be the centerpiece of a new tactic. And that's always the sign that you're playing something pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I definitely haven't sort of like written it off or anything. I think it's more the case of like, when an opponent got to that square before I did and cut off my route, I was like, well, I might as well restart it now. There's no point carrying on.
Yeah.
When that happened, I was like, oh, is this definitely good then? Because, you know what I mean? Just because it's sort of like, because is it sort of like, and it sort of made me feel the way that the random rule did in Final Fantasy VIII, where it's like, there's nothing I can do about this, and it's making me sad, and like I'm furious. But at least, you know, I will say that's a big difference. There's Triple Triad, no restart button. This has a restart button, and if you hit restart, you can even just back out of the menu, and like nothing bad happens to you. Like right. That. It's like it's very low stakes, I think, and that's a good decision. So yeah,
that is part of it, and certainly like. I've played a lot of this game where if it doesn't give me my opening hand that I need, I'm like, well, I may as well not play this. You know, I may as well restart because, like, I always want to play my Cactuar in the top left corner, and then I want to put a Choco Rowan Mog just below, beneath it. You know, then I'm off to a good start already. But I don't know. I've just seen enough people doing, like, really mad shit with this and playing different decks, and it's complicated enough to sustain being a mini game in a 100-hour RPG, but it's not complicated enough to be a standalone card game that I would inevitably be shit at, like Hearthstone, you know?
Yeah.
It's got enough game that you can master it in the amount of time that you'll probably be playing Rebirth, which is kind of what a game of this kind should be aiming for.
Yeah.
I don't want a standalone game in this game. I want, you know, like Gwent, after a while in The Witcher 3, there are certain tactics where if you had those cards, you would just always win. Like, you were using spies to just take more cards. You would just have more cards. You would inevitably fuck them over. And that was, you know, that was the second half of the game, was just playing that move over and over again. But you don't really care because you're like, well, I built this deck. I amassed this. I don't mind going around thumping all these losers. And they have real fun with the competitors. Like every Queen's Blood match, there's a little gag with it. You're playing a chocobo, or you're playing a man who sings a little song on the guitar when he loses, or playing a character who you fought elsewhere in the game and has come back. Like, oh, it was a boss, but now it's a Queen's Blood person.
That's like the DNA of a Final Fantasy minigame as well, is that it's something that's persistent. It's something that stays with you for the journey throughout the game. Right. It's like, that's what, you know, it's what Blitzball did. I mean, I'm the only person who likes Blitzball, but
I don't think I've had that relationship with a Final Fantasy minigame like that, though, you know?
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because did 15 have any minigames? Apart from, like, the cooking, but it kind of doesn't really count.
There was, like, some pinball. No, I don't think it did. Fishing?
No. Yeah, fishing. It did have fishing, actually, yeah. And so, but that I didn't really engage with that much. 13 definitely didn't. And I guess, like, you have only really played 10, which 10 has Blitzball, and that's very divisive.
And we skipped that, because Catherine was like, don't bother.
Yeah, which is fair enough. And then there's, obviously, you've been playing 7 itself. And 7, I guess, like, to the end of Disc 1, you kind of have the Chocobo racing, which I don't think is great in 7, honestly. And also the, like, motorbike sort of like thwacking mini game, which is quite fun, but also right. There's only one track for it, there's only one stretch of game you can do it on, so there's not loads of longevity to it. Yeah. There's the, well, actually no, I guess I almost spoiled a mini game then, but you don't know what that's alluding to, so I won't mention it. Yeah, so there's like other stuff in there, but I can see why you haven't encountered this before. But I guess, like, what about elsewhere, Matthew? How do you feel about the Chocobo stealth game? You good with that one?
When you've come up through Wii and DS, you have played so many rancid mini games. My not necessarily appetite for them, but like ability to tolerate them, and also like to very quickly figure out what I need to do to get through it. To keep going back to Rob, you know, he's been Rob Pearson, who we had on the podcast a few months ago. You know, he's been playing this at work, and I know that he had quite a rough time with the Chocobo stealth games, where I just sort of shrugged them off and did it. You know, I didn't really worry about it. Didn't particularly love it. I thought, oh, that was funny that they did like a weird game where you have to push minecarts to hide from the steely glare of a chocobo.
it's so funny the way they are looking at you while you're moving. And like, right. because that's how they show you that the chocobo will see you if you break out of cover.
Right.
But the chocobo must be aware that you're there in order to look at you in the first place. And it just stares at you with this gormless expression of like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, just like head empty, no thoughts, kind of like vibes.
It plays like a little kind of sort of noirish, sort of sultry version of the chocobo theme.
yeah, I quite like it. So those are the kind of the main ones I've encountered so far.
Have you done a mock toadstool yet?
No, but that is in the original game, and it is awful in the original game.
Wait, so in the original game, that's in the arcade, right?
Yeah, it's like a storybooky thing, and then you do it once, so, and then you don't do it again.
What it is now, it actually feels like a fucked like Nintendo Land game. It looks a little bit like Mario Chase.
Right. Oh, okay. Great game.
You have to chase moglings back to the central. It's like a sheep herding game, basically.
Right. Okay.
You're herding these moglings back to this toadstool, but while you're doing it, they're all throwing shit at you. Not actual shit. They're throwing like different tricks at you, and like,
yeah,
if you get hit like a couple of times, you have to restart the whole thing. And it's absolutely fine up until like the last couple in the game, because with each time you complete one, like the intensity goes up. And by the end, it's like doing a fucking bullet hell game, except there's these moglins chucking like fire, lightning, wind, bombs, all this stuff at you. It is so infuriating. That is the worst mini game in Rebirth by a long way, is the Mog Toadstool.
Okay, that's interesting. So not all great then.
Oh,
so
no, a lot of them are only fine. There's like a frog version of a Fall Guys level where you have to jump over these. You get turned into a frog and you have to jump over these spinning bars. That's quite fun. Right. It's like a Mario Party game. That's quite good.
Yeah.
Have you done any of the Fort Conda stuff yet?
No. Was that in the Yuffie thing?
Yeah, it was.
I did that, got furious at it, and then decided to like never play again, basically.
Right. Well, that's back in a big way.
Okay.
Kind of a tower defense, like two lanes, and you basically place units, AI units, and they walk towards the other end attacking things. I mean, I guess there's a, what is that? Is that a MOBA? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's not quite RTS. It's a little bit, yeah, sort of auto battler kind of thing.
It has this like initial wow factor because it's all done in this polygonal style, rendered as these sort of chunky little action figures. Rather than being a place you go to, Fort Condor, it's like a board game that exists in the world. I like the visual style of it. I liked it up until difficulty got so high on it. It felt like if you didn't have a specific solution to it, you weren't ever going to solve it. But the fact that you complete all those and then it unlocks a hard mode of it, so there's like an extra level of it. You can customize your army at the start of each round. Like, it's a fully thought out thing. That's what's kind of amazing about a lot of the mini games here, is that there's a customization element to them. There's always a prior stage, and that sometimes ties into like other things that happen in the game. So like when you get to chocobo racing in Rebirth, you don't breed the chocobos, but the cosmetics you are collecting elsewhere in the game suddenly give them stat increases in different ways. So you have to dress your chocobo to change how it handles in the race. A bit like, and it's like Mario Kart. It's like customizing a Mario Kart. You just realize that there's so much in this game which is actually set up or ties into a mini game somewhere else in an interesting way. And I come away from that going like, wow, the scale and ambition of it. That's so funny. No, it's another Yakuza thing. It's like everything feeds into something else in a really playful way. But a lot of people have just gone, it just feels like it's all mini games. You know, this is a game which just feels like you're moving between mini games because they're so substantial that they can eat up that much time that they feel like they are the game. And I guess for those people, yes, that's a flaw.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense, I guess. But interesting. I kind of like hearing you rationalize sort of mini games. You are genuinely an authority on this, like you say, based on your your sort of like days on Endgame.
I just hate it when people are like, oh, it's bad because it's a mini game.
Yeah.
As if that means anything. Some of the best games of all times have been mini games. You know, Monkey Target is a great mini game that could be a thing in itself. And obsessions can build around a great mini game. And I think in Queen's Blood, this genuinely has a... I love Queen's Blood. I think it is an all-timer as far as mini games go. But I'm a big Gwent guy, so I would say that. It just makes me laugh how many mini games are in this.
Right.
And they've made so much game that's bespoke, like, interface and rules and, like, God damn it, they were making a lot of game in those 4 years. They just must have been making from day one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite intense. I would say in general, the sort of thing that's hit me the most playing this game is I'm a bit overwhelmed by how much has been chucked into this remake of something that meant a lot to me 2 decades ago. And just how I just can't believe the extraordinary undertaking of it and how beautifully rendered it is. Like, all I keep thinking when I'm walking around is, imagine I could send this back in time to myself in like at my peak FF7 fandom was probably when Advent Children came out in 06. So just imagine looking at this game and thinking, okay, this looks almost as, this probably looks slightly better than Advent Children did then, now. Right. And you are playing it and look how vividly they've, you know, realized all this. Look how detailed the fur on Red 13 is. Look how cool these animations are. I'm just quite overwhelmed by it as an undertaking. It's almost like the scale of it is, it just seems unsustainable. Like making a game this big, you know what I mean? It's you know, it's just extremely generous. And I think that's probably the point I'd make there about the mini games. It's generous. How can you be mad at something that's this generous? I mean, you know, it's sort of like, it's just, and so much of it is just so considered as well. It doesn't, you're not, at least what I've played so far, I have not been sat there thinking, this feels like filler in the way that the Clive Meonions quest did in 16. So that's
second drive by on the onion desiring NPC.
All I think about is the Gav's. Is it Gav? Someone's nan asking you to get ingredients for stew. I was just like, nah. I can't. I'm sorry, I can't. And this does have objectives like that, but there's something about the way the quests are designed in terms of dropping characters into cutscenes. Oh, Tifa's here to say something, or Barrett's here to say something, where it just feels like there's a little bit more of a treat for you in doing it. And yeah.
It's Barrett going, yeah, let's get those onions, and you're like, fucking yes, I'm now invested in these onions. Barrett, if they matter to you, they matter to me.
Yeah, okay, so fair enough. I don't feel like I've seen loads of criticism towards the mini games, though. So I think a lot of people are genuinely appreciating it. I mean, maybe individual mini games are not going as well as others, but Queen's Blood certainly getting the acclaim. Matthew, without spoiling anything major, which bits from the original do you think shine the most in Rebirth?
Definitely the boss fights, in terms of taking these things, which were, you know, quite, you know, iconic and memorable as creature creations, but just showing them in this amazing light and having these multi-stage fights which like bring out a lot more character, you know, like, you know you fight the Midgar Zorma, the snake early on, and you know, quite a thrilling boss fight with several conceptual phases to it that you have to master, and ends in this really spectacular way. Those have all been pretty great. You know, I'm always counting down to like, oh, I wonder how they're going to do X, and they inevitably do that really well. I think the Gold Saucer is absolutely like this game in a nutshell, not just because it's mini game city, the fact that, you know, if you remember Gold Saucer, you know, from the original, it's quite a weird place, like tonally it's made up of all these different zones, none of them really match up. You kind of go into these warp pipes and you come out and then it's like a weird haunted house, and you go into another one and it's chocobo racing, or you go into this one, you know, they do all that and they don't shy away from, if we're going to do a haunted house, let's fucking do a proper haunted house so it looks really weird and spooky and has all this like little sight gags hidden in it, and they've just not shied away from any of it, and that's a really great place to be. And really the ultimate thing is probably like the music across the board, the way it takes these themes, which by dint of them, you know, replaying on a loop when you're playing the original, are kind of somewhere in the depths of your mind, and they take them and spin them out into new things. You know, I've likened it before to kind of the project that Smash Brothers did in terms of taking all these great composers, giving them the classic works of Nintendo and going, just create like fun remixes on this. You know, what's a kind of techno remix of, you know, The Legend of Zelda going to sound like, or what's a classical rendition of an F-Zero theme tune going to sound like, or whatever. And they've done that, but just for Final Fantasy VII music. And, you know, I think in one of the states of play, they said, like, there are 400 tracks in this game. And you're like, well, that's mad. That can't be true. But you're playing it, and every moment has a great piece of music behind it. Every mini game has a cool piece of music. Every region has a beautiful overworld theme, which then becomes a banging combat theme because it transitions into a new piece of music when you enter the combat. And just hearing them riff on the most, like, iconic material, you know, audible material possible is absolutely amazing. I mean, the Cosmo Canyon overworld theme is just unreal. Like, it's so good. This, like, sort of banjo rendition of how the overworld sounded. And then it goes into the theme, you know, when combat kicks off, it just becomes so exciting. It's like you're in a fucking spaghetti western. You're like, This is crazy how much effort they've put into this. I honestly think if you just bought this as a 70 quid soundtrack, you'd get your money's worth.
Yeah, it's funny because again, you don't have the history with that music that other people do, but you're really tuned into what an achievement that is. And I even thought that was true about Remake as well. But
yeah
this would appear to push it further. It's sort of like it's the way they'll use bits of the original music is like music cues sometimes. So you'll do something and you'll hear. And I'm just like, oh, wow, that's a really cool... They've thought about this in just such a careful way.
I really like that they've... I would say in the 70 hours that I've played, there've only been a couple of moments where it's lent into that like weird meta stuff that was quite prevalent in Remake.
Yeah.
Remake, you know, there are these kind of whisper ghosts that turn up and have an impact on the story and kind of reflect a certain power exerting influence on the story. And
they save Wedge. You know, they save Wedge from death.
They save Wedge. I've been amazed at how little of that there is. It really is just content to be a maximalist version of the original story. There is an undercurrent, which is obvious from the very opening of the game, that it will be doing something slightly different. But even that, it only returns to like every 10, 15 hours and for like a couple of minutes, and then it moves on again. So I've kind of enjoyed like how pure it is.
I feel like they're responding to criticism maybe, and so kind of portioning that off a little bit, you know.
All that stuff in Remake was doing the heavy lifting just to introduce the what if at the end of this game.
Yeah.
Well, that's all we wanted to do, was for you to think it might not play out the same way, and that is enough of an idea to be exciting.
Yeah.
So we don't need to keep reinforcing it. By all accounts, it does go more in that direction, like towards the end.
Right, right.
I am intrigued to see how. Gold Source aside, which is obviously absolutely amazing, a couple of things to shout out. I think Barrett's a bit more of an interesting character in this. They find some fun ways to tie him to other members of the party, like Barrett and Yuffie have some really cool stuff in this game, because the particular kind of target of their fury at Shinra is the same person, and it kind of gives them common ground, which is kind of interesting. Barrett's storyline, if you remember from the original, like it sort of deals with his past. I really like that sequence in the game. I thought they just gave it more time to breathe, and they really landed that. On a lighter note, the Junin parade, where Rufus Shinra is being sort of inauguration of Rufus Shinra, and Cloud has to infiltrate a parade as a soldier and sort of march his way through. That becomes like a whole to do about like building a parade, which is so silly, and it's just full of like mad jokes. There's a joke involving Rude, one of the Turks, which is just a peak moment of surreal oddness that I just didn't see coming. I just think they've really got it, this team. They kind of meddle with it just enough that it's unexpected, but little enough that you can go, yeah, they ticked the box. They gave me that moment as I wanted it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that's probably... We're about, I think, there in terms of discussing how we feel about the game so far, Matthew. So,
yeah, I feel like I've talked at you a lot about this, and this is just because I'm so much further ahead in it. And
no, that's fine.
Like, I definitely want to kind of return to this once you finish it. Maybe we need to do like once two giant men have finished Rebirth episode.
I don't know about that. I think we can just sort of come back to it at the end of the year. You know, or maybe I'll talk about it. If I do finish it, I can talk about it in one of the What We've Been Playing episodes. But yeah, I think it's sort of like, it's just such a lot of game to get your arms around. And I sort of do have strong feelings about what I have played so far. I can see the ways in which it's succeeding. I do see how the kind of like more amusing tone sort of filters into it. There's some stuff where I'm still like, do they definitely have a handle on Aerith and Tifa as characters and how they differentiate from each other? Because you kind of have to fill in the gaps a little bit with them as personalities, because they're not huge, they're quite passive presences in the original game, so it's interesting to see them wrestle with that. I do think every location is amazing. That's one thing, actually, I think that is a massive achievement about this versus other Final Fantasy games, is that the RPG town has felt very missing from HD era Final Fantasy games. Like, they've never quite got that sort of like Wonderland feel that I think you want from a location. I'm not saying every location does in this, some of them are deliberately smaller and more modest and that sort of thing, but the moment in this game where you're just like in Calm and it's like a district in Disneyland is properly amazing. It's just like I'm in a real place. I don't even think Calm was that distinctive in the original game. I always just think of it as, oh, that's the place you go to and hear the flashback, right? And so
I think I muddled it up with Nibelheim when I did my summary of it in the episode, you know.
Maybe.
Because I thought he was in Nibelheim. He was like, this is what happened here in Nibelheim.
Oh, right. I feel like I would have corrected you on that, but maybe it was maybe it was like late in the year and my brain had turned to mashed potato, which does often happen. So,
but like, they're very similar, you know.
Yeah,
small village with like a slightly kind of like alpine vibe.
That's the funny thing though, is that Nibelheim, I think in my head, was the same size as Calm, and like looking at it in like FF7 sort of like, you know, pre-rendered backgrounds, but in this game it's way smaller than Calm. Calm is like massive and there's loads of different moving parts to it, but again, like, it's nice to see a proper full-blooded RPG town. It's like, it's one of the things that's missing from 15, right? You play it and you're like, all there is this, like, you know, the Venice you go to via a loading screen, and then also just the one small town you can walk around in that's in the actual like open world bit. So yeah,
and some diners. That is an RPG where you only go to Little Chefs.
Yeah, which is like, I think, quite distinctive and cool about it.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
But you do miss, I think you do miss the kind of like traditional town based experience. And of course, going back to 13, it had no towns, and that's what was controversial about it to some players. So yeah, it's I think it's just nice to see them like picking up some of the fundamentals of what people loved about Final Fantasy and then just like nailing them and then moving on to the next one. So yeah, I am enjoying what I've played so far. The combat is the one thing where I'm trying to decide where I land on it, because there's that thing where, like you say, boss battles, you do have to prepare a little bit more, but there's so much kind of like fudging it then goes on, and it feels so frantic that I'm sometimes like, oh, how much of this am I actually in control of? Do I feel in control of it in the way that I do in the original game? And I think the answer is I don't really, but that's just the sort of nature of the beast. That's not necessarily like a bad thing, but it's just I'm still wrestling with how I feel about that exactly, you know. So
I think there are definitely fights where it almost takes me a death to lock in, like, well, I needed to do this differently, and then I have purpose. You know, if you scrape through it, it always feels a bit messy.
Yeah.
But if you get your ass handed to you and then come out with quite a clean victory, you're like, no, I understood. I understood what was asked of me, and I did it. And that's a very satisfying feeling in this game.
Definitely, yeah. So, yeah, I am enjoying it a lot, and I think it's, again, it's just a very generous game. I will get through it, and we will talk about it again at some point, Matthew. So that is my last question then to see out the episode. So do you think this is the best attempt to modern Final Fantasy to date? Sorry, I didn't say that correctly, did I? For context, Matthew, I'm on a 600 calorie day today, so that's why my brain's a little bit fuddled.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so I'm going to eat a couple of new potatoes after this as a treat.
I've eaten 600 calories while recording this podcast.
Yeah, there's a couple of... I wonder if people can guess, actually. There's been a couple before this where I've done 600 calorie days and I've been a little bit out of it. But yes, I try and hide it as best I can. So do you think this is the best attempt to modernise Final Fantasy to date?
As someone who isn't like a super scholar of it, I would say... yes. I know that there's the Final Fantasy 14 of it all, and people have very strong ideas about that and how maybe that represents optimal Final Fantasy. But as someone who just isn't interested in doing that whole kind of time commitment, I want a self-contained game, self-contained story. Okay, this is only the middle section of a bigger story. But I think this is the marriage of kind of the technology delivering the kind of visual wonder where you're just like, holy shit, this is absolutely amazing, which is always a feeling I think Final Fantasy used to evoke. It was always just ahead of the game in that regard, and this certainly has that spectacle to it. But I think it also has kind of found slightly richer characters, which, you know, I'm not saying that's a weakness of the series, but just with modern day technology, you know, where voice acting's at and performance capture and you know, the nature of the storytelling and how it's cinematically presented. I find this bunch very, very easy to root for, and paired with, you know, what is naturally a great story, I think that's just a really potent combination. No shade or anything else, though. I've enjoyed most of the modern ones, to be honest.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the journey they've taken to sort of get to this point. And I think if we say that 16's an 8, right? I'd say like a mid to high 8, then this is a 9 for sure. And yeah, they're both
super coherent games, which is like a big tick for both of them. I just think this has a bit more going on under the hood than 16 had.
Yeah, I think that is true. I don't disagree with that. I think there's loads that still loved about 16 and the scale of it and the sort of big moments really landed. But you know, I think the criticism of it is fair. This just feels more like the complete package in a way that I haven't seen from Final Fantasy for quite a long time. So, yes, well done everyone involved. We will talk about it again at some point, Matthew, but thank you so much for playing it for 70 hours. Thank you for your sacrifice. And
That's all right. It was a pleasure. I love this game.
Ah, that's great. I'm glad to hear. So, yeah, no doubt it'll come up on your end of the year list. So who knows? Because we're in March and there are like 5 Game of the Year contenders already. Yeah. So you played Bellatro yet, Matthew? That happened for you?
I haven't. I will get on it. I just want to tick off some of these other things first.
Yeah, do it, because it'll eat at least a month of your life, I'm sure. So definitely try and avoid that if you can. Okay, well, thank you so much for listening. This podcast is supported by our patrons at patreon.com/backpagepod, where you can get 2 additional podcasts a month. This month we just did 2 Giant Men Play Hitman Blood Money. So that was quite funny. We talked about how that game, the 2006 game, relates to the World of Assassination trilogy, and through that lens, and talked about some of the tonal choices they make in that game and how some of the levels are more inconsistent. That was a really fun episode. And we're going to do later this month 2 Giant Men Watch Dune Parts 1 and 2, or it's technically 2 Baron Harkonnens Watch Dune Parts 1 and 2. So we'll talk about those movies. So that's what you get if you support us on their £4.50 tier. But any of your support is greatly appreciated. Matthew, where can people find you on social media?
I am Mr. Basil_Pesto on Twitter, and I am Mr. Basil_Pesto_ on Blue Sky, where I actually do have a little bit of exclusive Blue Sky content for you.
Yeah, about Eater Pitter.
About Eater Pitter, which I think I talked about in the Patreon. So.
Yeah, XL tier subscribers, they know. The real heads know. So that is on there. I'm Samuel W. Roberts on both Twitter and Blue Sky. The podcast is Backpage Pod on both as well. You can tweet us if you have questions or thoughts of the podcast, that sort of thing. There is also a Discord linked in the Twitter and Blue Sky profiles. Almost 1,000 people in there now, Matthew, so that's daunting. I don't know who they all are. Only about 20 of them comment, but it's very nice in there, and I hope everyone's having a good time. So good stuff. Surviving my occasional drive-bys in there. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Goodbye.